I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid.
When I was a teenager, and I don't know where I got this, but somehow I morphed that song into, I don't want to get up. I'm a tired ass kid.
Nice. Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Oh, hello. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by all of you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
It is all trade and tariffs today. Not all. There will be some detours into, at least for my fixation fix, a little bit of lightness, no pun intended, as you will see. But trade and tariffs is the body of the podcast today because holy cow, it's a big deal. More of them are coming. More of them have been coming this week. We're going to do a little where we are and what it means and where we go, really, with Doug Irwin. He's an economics professor up at Dartmouth.
Yeah. Think of this as the Why God Why show. Why? Why? About trade and tariffs. I mean, they're all that to some extent, but this time it's about trade and tariffs. We will also take, we'll get a front row seat look from entrepreneurs who are actually dealing with the new tariffs in real time. So expect some crying, I assume.
Yeah, right.
Maybe not. Maybe not.
Maybe not. Maybe not. We'll see. And then we'll do the news. But first, some music. All right. To be clear, it's not really news because you can't do news in a weekly podcast. What you can do is sort of zeitgeisty. Listen, here's what's on my mind, which is what we've turned this into.
Yep. Aren't we clever? Look at us with our machinations.
Look at us adapting to the news cycle and the podcast drop cycle, or the PDC, as we say in the trade. We don't really.
Do we?
Okay. No, we don't. We don't. I just made that up. I'm going first, I assume, since I'm the recalcitrant one in this letting everybody know what's going on thing.
Yes, please. Also, mine is sort of related to the topic at hand.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be a segue.
Mine is not at all, and it's actually a little ray of, once again, pun not intended, sunshine in an otherwise really gruesomely bleak set of news. I can't stop thinking about this Thai soccer team that they found in the cave after like 11 days. So here's the deal, right? And I'm sure you've seen these stories. They found them in the cave crawling through underwater. These divers were going and they popped up and there they were. But here's the deal. They can't figure out how to get these kids out. And I read today in the New York Times, they're saying, well, maybe we'll wait 4 months until rainy season ends and then we'll get them out. And I'm like, oh, no, you won't. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you have two choices. You can teach them how to dive like scuba and all that jazz, or you can have them wait 4 months.
Whoa.
I'll take the diving lessons, please. But I think it's cool they found them, right? I mean, they didn't give up. They kept on going. They found them, and now they're going to teach them how to use this gear and get them out. And I just think that's awesome.
It is amazing. And they installed like a phone line so that they can talk to their families. Yeah. And it was really one of those.
Yeah.
I heard it. You know, that's actually really funny, Kai, because I had a feeling you were going to choose that story today.
No, baloney.
No, I'm not kidding. In fact, I read up on it. I was like, I just think he's going to choose that. Yeah.
Wow. Because I was going to go with Scott Pruitt, but then I was like, I'm not doing that.
Well, and really, at this point, how many more times do we have to do that story? Right. And how many more times do we have to do the Wilbur Ross short-selling stock? Right. Like, that happened again, too. Right.
But you got kids who were separate, they were literally lost, and now they're found, and that's kind of awesome. And, you know, they're going to figure out a way to get them out in the next couple of days. They're not going to make them wait 4 months.
I mean, the
4 months, by the way, was because of rainy season. It might not go away yet, and whatever.
Yeah, I hope so. At some point I had heard too that even the rescuers were stuck down there, but I don't know if that's true either.
Oh well. I don't know. Anyway, all right, that's mine. Top that.
Okay. I am fixated this week on Tesla because I just can't get enough of this of the Tesla meltdown in real time.
Yep.
And I do not and it's so ever since we had Adam Ruins Everything on our show, and he talked about doing that episode about green batteries and getting all that angry mail from the Tesla people. I have noticed that happens every time you mention, like, hey, Tesla might be falling apart a tiny bit. I don't know. I'm just thinking maybe they need to make cars. Then people freak out, and you get all these, like, angry emails. So twin pieces of news this week. One, Tesla announced that, hallelujah, they managed to make 7,000 cars in 7 days. And so they hit this production goal that was supposed to be 5,000 cars, which is obviously completely unsustainable because the only way they hit this goal in this case was that they built an extra factory under a tent in the parking lot.
In the parking lot, that's right.
And
I love that.
Elon Musk has slept there every day for 7 days, presumably with some sort of an electric bullwhip, because the man is just like lost it at this point. So sounds like a good, you know, intentional plan for future success.
Yeah.
So there's that. There is a great story in The Guardian today that gets at many of the trends that we have talked about on this show, which is like when a business comes to town, it isn't always a good thing. It's about the Tesla factory that came to Sparks, Nevada, and how the influx of tech jobs, which is so often the case, has pushed many, many people out of their homes. How the tax credits that were given to Tesla have dramatically depleted public services so that they can't fill the potholes or build affordable housing or, you know, fix the schools. Yeah. So there's that kind of like what happens when business gets whatever it wants, which is completely related to, you know, is Foxconn coming to town and is that costing Wisconsin $1 million a head? And then finally, the trade question, which is that apparently Tesla, among all of the automakers, is almost the most at risk if there are increased car tariffs.
Yeah.
Auto tariffs.
The president has been talking about.
The president has been talking about. So this company in general has just sort of been limping along on strength of its genius. And because I am also reading the Elizabeth Holmes book right now, Bad Blood.
Oh, the one about Theranos. Yeah.
About Theranos.
Boy, is that a good book. Yeah.
I just have to say that limping along on strength of your genius with a pseudo-fictional product. And, to be fair, Tesla has built great cars that have been very expensive and very bespoke. And there is no sign whatsoever that they can make a mainstream vehicle that's only going to get harder. And I just can't stop. I can't stop reading about it, especially the factory lit that they built under a tent. Amazing.
Totally. I love that. I was out walking the dogs with my 17-year-old last night. We got to talking about this, and he said, they're not really going to fail that, are they? They're not going to go out of business. And I'm like, dude, man, if they can't make the product, what are they going to do?
Right.
You know, and that's the catch now. Right.
They have one job.
He's bet the whole company on this Model 3, and if he doesn't get there, I don't know.
And not for nothing, all the cars that they're building now and the cars that they have prioritized getting off the line because they need to pay for continued cars are the like $75,000 version
of
the $35,000
car. Right.
Nobody, like people aren't going to get that $35,000 one until maybe 2020.
Yep.
That's not a mainstream car.
Nope.
It's absurd.
Nope. Bananas.
All right. That's my obsession. But we have a new obsession for you. I can tell you that my son is obsessed with this.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
oh,
I'm so getting a little tired of hearing you and me come out of our Alexa speaker because
go ahead. We're still in the tell me a joke phase in my house, but whatever.
Oh, no,
Alexa, tell me a joke? Oh, yeah, totally.
I mean, yeah, no, but we're have you reprogrammed Alexa? Did you know you can do this?
Can I? Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, you can, in the app, you can actually create it. So I'm not proud of this, but we programmed ours. Because I'm a 14-year-old boy with an 11-year-old boy, so that when I ask it who farted, it tells me that it was probably Eli, my son. you can build in custom responses.
Oh, my God. All right, I'm going to have to do that. But that's not what we're here to talk to you about.
Before you do any of that, though, the secret is out.
Oh my God.
I love our most roundabout introduction to the secret ever. The secret is out that we gave you a 30-hour head start on last week.
Yes.
Make Me Smart is now on the Amazon Echo. You can actually ask it in addition to who farted.
You can.
To make you smart.
So here's the deal. Got to have an Amazon Echo, of course. And all you got to do is say, Alexa, make me smart. And then Molly and I come out of your speaker. It's the most remarkable thing. It's the most amazing thing.
Like, it actually is really awesome. And then we made all these little explainers, the whole team, not just me and Kai. And so there's a little, it's like about a minute long, maybe 90 second update on the economics of the royal wedding or 5G or summer blockbusters. There's one on FIFA that the bosses are super excited about right now because it's like it's right on top of the World Cup, which Kai and I are also secretly obsessed with. It's on behind me. I'm just saying, in preparation for
that. Gotta have it on in front of you, yo. But there's a way you can like request things out of this and figure out, you know, what you want to get made smart about, and then we will do it. It's kind of amazing. So let us know. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Tweet us at Kai Rosedahl, at Molly Wood, as we've said 11 bajillion times, and we'll hook you up.
Yeah. All credit, I got to say, to our one-man dev team, Brian. I know there's more than
joke.
But I was thinking, like, it's so cool that the public radio engineer got to, like, make an awesome next-generation skill.
Yep.
I don't think that happens that much, so. Good job, guys.
Super cool.
All right, time for some tunes.
And then Doug Irwin and Trade.
I made the tunes. Made the tunes go.
All right. Are we in a trade war or not? My answer is yes, I believe we are. But this is a big, big week on trade policy. We've got Canadian tariffs started the 1st of July. We've got Mexican tariffs starting on the 5th of July. We've got Chinese tariffs probably starting on the 6th of July. There's retaliation going on all over the place. Beef, pork, soybeans, ketchup, you name it. Caffeinated roasted coffee, because I don't know what's up with decaf. And there's just all kinds of tariffs going on, way apart from elsewhere on public radio that you've been hearing about motorcycles and bourbon. So there's a lot to talk about.
I just love that no one can even be bothered to tax decaf at all. This is also a fair time to bring up the fact that apparently, maybe, the proposed legislation from the White House that would blow up the World Trade Organization is also called the FART Act.
Yes.
I'm sensing a theme on today's show. Our guest, Doug Irwin, is going to help us break this all down. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
come on. Is this news? Doug is a professor of economics at Dartmouth College. He has written numerous books on trade and trade war. Unfortunately, we did not get to him before the FART Act was reported in the news, so we're not going to talk about that again. Kai started off asking him your basic Kai question, which is, make me care.
Make me give a shit about global trade, right? Because we've had so much going on. I need you at this point in time, this week, with Canada and China and retaliation and motorcycles and lions and tigers and bears, oh my goodness, make me care.
Well, it's like one of those things that you don't really miss it until you don't have it anymore. We've taken it for granted for so long that we'd have the free flow of goods between North American countries, Asia, Europe, and what have you. It's sort of background noise to us. But talk about disrupting it, and all of a sudden, consumers will pay a higher price, businesses will pay a higher price, and may have to lay off workers. Yes, there'll be some domestic producers that will benefit by being insulated from foreign competition, but there are many more losers, both in terms of the business community and in terms of consumers.
I guess I'm trying to understand what is true and why the various approaches.
Well, there's what's true and then what concerns the president. And those two may not be exactly the same thing.
Oh, look, 2018.
Yeah, let's take NAFTA as an example. So he's constantly said NAFTA is a terrible trade agreement and Canada and Mexico are taking advantage of us and they're making money at our expense. Now, if you look at NAFTA, what it requires is that countries apply basically zero tariffs on each other's goods. So that's a level playing field. Mexico applies a 0% tariff on most U.S. imports, and we do the same with them, and also the same is true with Canada, although there is an exception for dairy with Canada, just as there's an exception for sugar with the United States. Mm-hmm. Every country has their own little exceptions. But that's a free trade agreement that cuts tariffs down to zero. What the president doesn't like is that there's a trade imbalance between our countries. So we have a trade deficit with Mexico, for example. But the issue here is that trade agreements don't lead necessarily to any particular trade outcome in terms of trade balances. Trade agreements set the rules for trade, the rules of the road and what the tariffs will be. They don't necessarily mandate or require or bring about any particular outcome in terms of what the value of exports or imports will be. And I think most economists would say that the trade imbalances that we see between countries is much more driven by macroeconomic factors, capital flows, and exchange rates, rather than trade agreements per se.
Yeah, no, as long as we're being really basic, tell us what a trade imbalance is. We buy more things from Canada than they buy from us.
Exactly. So actually, there has been a dispute between the president and Justin Trudeau, the prime minister of Canada, about what the value of the trade surplus or deficit is between our two countries, the U.S. and Canada, because actually the U.S., in terms of goods and services, runs a surplus with Canada, and the president has focused on the goods balance, which is a deficit. Now, what that means is that if there's a goods deficit, we are importing more from Canada than we're exporting to them. But when you include services in the mix, and we are largely a service economy, we're actually exporting or selling more to Canada than we're importing from them. Now, one reason why we have a deficit with Mexico, that is we're buying more from Mexico than we're exporting to them, is we ship a lot of chassis and auto parts to Mexico. When they come back after being assembled in Mexico, the value of those imports includes the value of what we've exported to them. So in other words, if we export a $100 part to Mexico, it's wrapped up into an automobile, the automobile comes back and it's worth $200. Well, those $200 of imports, 100 of that is already U.S. content. So there's a bit of a misleading statistics element to this in terms of counting bilateral trade balances. If that made any sense. No,
well, it did. But let me ask two follow-up questions, right? One is, it's not all about manufacturing, right? It's about global trade in everything.
Yep. The president and his advisors seem very concerned about manufacturing in particular.
Right.
So they've sort of thrown agriculture a little bit under the bus here.
Yep.
In the sense that they're getting retaliated against and they face foreign trade barriers. But the president seems to really worry about blue-collar workers in manufacturing. He has this idea of many of us should be in factories, that we making things. That's what made America great. And we have to go back to that sort of economy. But we really have become a service economy. Agriculture is still important. So you're right. The economy is much more than just manufacturing, even though that's where the focus of the administration's efforts seem to have been.
Yeah. So to that end, then, riffing on a piece that Scott Tong did for Marketplace, one of our reporters, a number of weeks ago, is it fair to say that what the Trump administration is trying to do is to protect the industries of the past, while the Chinese, for instance, are looking to protect their industries of the future, digital and technology and intellectual property?
That would be a fair statement. If you look at the Made in China 2025 initiative, it's focusing on high growth sectors in the future. You're right, digital economy, intellectual property. And the Trump administration seems very concerned about automobiles and steel. We still have a lot of steel production here and a lot of automobile production. They just don't employ as many workers as they did in the past because they've become so automated. And they're using very capital intensive methods with very sophisticated technology. But those industries are of the past in terms of big employers, but they're still obviously important parts of the economy.
So what's interesting is that often, historically, when trade wars start, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a protectionist reaction when a country's economy is down. Clearly these manufacturing sectors, these particular sectors have lost jobs, but the economy overall is very strong. So does the argument make sense, the protectionist argument right now?
Well, regardless of whether the argument makes sense, it certainly is very unusual to see a lot of trade tensions when generally the world economy and the U.S. included in that are doing very well in terms of keeping unemployment down and reasonable growth rates. So when we looked at seen trade disputes in the past, either in the 1980s when we had trade friction with Japan or the 1930s when there really was a trade war in the world economy, those have tended to be periods of slow growth, if not recessions, and very high rates of unemployment. And so we're not sort of in the usual configuration of economic circumstances, one would say, to sort of have expected a lot of trade friction at this point in where we are in terms of the business cycle. And that's why I think President Trump has really been special, because even though the economy is doing well, he's really itching to pick a big trade fight with a lot of our allies and non-allies.
Could we pause for a moment to acknowledge that at least in some regard, the president has a point in this? And I'm speaking specifically now about China and the theft of intellectual property and forced technology transfer. There is some merit to taking a tougher line. I guess I wonder if the question is, what's the right methodology?
Right. So I think you're absolutely right. The president is onto something with regard to China. Past administrations have sort of wanted to sort of ignore it or look beyond those particular problems that foreign firms face in terms of getting access to the Chinese market. So then the question becomes, well, what do you do about it? And in the past, what has worked is that when there are specific complaints that can be identified, WTO cases have been brought against China, and China generally has adhered to the rulings which have tended to run against them. Now, that may not be enough because a lot of the Chinese practices are not covered by WTO rules. And if they're not, then I think what the U.S. has to do is get a coalition of other concerned countries. And the U.S. is not alone here. Many European firms and European countries are very much concerned about China as well. and provide sort of maximal pressure on China to clean up its act. And for that, you do need allies. You can't do it alone, and you need to not alienate them, but sort of bring them on board with doing something about China. The president's been very upset with the higher tariff on imported automobiles that the European Union applies, 10% as opposed to our 2.5%. Mm-hmm. To the extent that we're concerned about those European tariffs, there's a very simple remedy there. That is to negotiate a free trade agreement with the EU, where they drop all of their tariff barriers down to zero, and we drop ours to zero. Presumably the president would like that because our tariffs, according to him, are lower than the European Union Union's tariffs, and that would be a deal where it would be win-win. But unfortunately, the Trump administration hasn't been pushing for the EU to negotiate with the U.S. on these tariffs. Instead, they've taken a much more belligerent stance of retaliating against them without constructively trying to reach a trade agreement to get rid of these trade barriers.
Everybody is sort of twisting themselves into knots to say, you know, this is fine, or ultimately this will maybe not have such a big impact as long as there's enough fiscal stimulus on the other side.
Oh, get a load of you. That's awesome. I'm so proud.
Apparently, the tariffs represent only about 0.4% of the nation's gross domestic product compared to...
That's awesome.
But if you are trying to make that argument, are you rationalizing the emotion behind these moves?
You could say that a good time to fight a trade war is when the economy is doing well, because that can absorb the blow. But I guess when you look back to the 80s, a lot of those trade wars, once again, occurring during recessions when unemployment was pretty high, those were designed to, you know, help out those workers who were unemployed. And it's very hard to see that you're really going to help out many blue-collar workers when the unemployment rate is relatively low and you're trying to resurrect these industries that have really moved beyond using a lot of labor to produce their output and have moved to much more capital-intensive and technology-intensive ways, such as autos and steel, as we've talked about. You know, the thing about steel, for example, is in the early 1980s, it took 10 worker hours to produce a ton of steel. Now it takes 2 worker hours to produce a ton of steel. Wow. So even if we rev up the steel industry, it's not going to rev up a lot of jobs.
Okay, so look, given that the emotions on this are running high, both out there in the economy where the president is playing to his base, which is loving this, and also... I'm going to assume here, but inside the mind of the president himself, right? He has staked a lot on these tariffs and his economic line in the sand. That being the case, how does this end? What's the climb down?
Well, it doesn't look like it's going to end well at the moment, because other countries are not sort of quaking in their boots saying, oh, tell us what you want, we'll give in to you under the Trump tariff threats. Instead, they've punched right back. That includes Canada, Mexico, the European Union, China. Others are retaliating. And you mentioned that maybe this plays well with his base. Well, if his base is a soybean farmer in the Midwest or Harley Davidson, which is trying to sell in other markets, and they're getting whacked by foreign tariffs, that's not going to play so well when you're disrupting how they can do business around the world. So one hopes that they're playing a very careful game, that they do have a goal in mind about what they want other countries to do to sort of walk back from all these tariff threats that have been made and the tariffs that actually have been imposed.
All right, so here's my riff on the most important part of that thing, which was the last, 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration went into this with no plan. There was no plan for what to do if somebody came back with retaliatory tariffs like everybody has done, other than to put more tariffs on them. And that is literally the definition of a trade war. And what we are seeing now, especially this week, is that other countries are going, seriously? Tariff me, tariff you. And there ain't nobody climbing down.
I think that that's... so interesting, because I assume the plan must have been, if we are just the biggest guy in the room,
right? Of course,
that people
want to be in our market, right?
Will back down, and of course they want to be in our market, and there is this sort of question of is that the thing that could contain the rampaging beast? Is if the rest of the world said no, thank you, I don't think so.
We're not seeing any cracks in the opposition armor, right? I mean, the Canadians are pissed off at us, and the Mexicans and the Chinese and the Europeans. There's literally nobody in the world who's not annoyed with us on trade right now.
Well, and then Republicans, at least according to Politico, are now starting to be very concerned that he's essentially at war with corporate America because of the trade war. And this is kind of, there's news just out as I was listening to this, to our own interview. saying that there are leaked documents that are showing that Chinese propaganda documents saying that China is explicitly using tariffs as a wedge issue to split apart Trump's base and quote different domestic groups in the U.S. So that, you know, by, for example, targeting soybeans. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I mean, talk about foreign intervention.
Right. Well, so, but here's the deal, right? We are seeing prices rise. Steel is more expensive and aluminum's more expensive and, you know, bourbon's more expensive and all of that jazz, right? But it's not hitting at the consumer level yet. It's still in that intermediate goods phase where those providers of those products are having to decide how much they are going to hit consumers with this. And they will, but it hasn't happened yet. And that's when it's really going to start kicking in, right? Because consumers are going to buy less, the economy will slow, fewer jobs, yada, blah, blah, blah. That's what's going
to
happen.
Right. But again, it's kind of like when there's a big data breach, not to bring it back to my turf, but you know how the impacts are so diffuse.
Yep.
And they take such a long time to materialize that it's hard to even tie them necessarily to one thing or the other.
Totally.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating.
So, with that as the sort of overarching sort of macro thing about this, we're going to do a little bit now, some tape from people on the ground dealing with the way the trade landscape is changing, right? Bunny Huang and Ji Qi run a startup company called Chibitronics, and they are business partners. He's in Singapore, she's in Boston. They sell kits that teach kids to program and work with electronics. A lot of their materials, which are circuits and electronic things, are made in China, cheap, so they can sell them affordably here to educators and public schools. Bunny summed up their reaction to the U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods that are set to start this Friday. Here you go.
We're freaking out.
I'm laughing so he doesn't cry.
And that is that. Exactly. That is the gist. But we do have a little some detail. Here's the why on the freakout. Bunny and G have a shipment of goods that are floating out at sea. And this is not the first time we've heard this tale, even on this podcast. And that shipment is in limbo.
So we set a shipment on the ocean sometime in mid-June. Before the tariffs were announced. And then we found out about the tariffs, and so we currently have a container full of goods chugging somewhere over the Pacific Ocean towards the port of New Jersey. These are the goods that were slated for the third quarter this year. Some of it's already spoken for by school systems. Some of it hasn't been sold yet. But the bottom line is now, like, we're in a bind as a business because we thought we had a cost of X when they left, and now they're going to have a cost of X plus 25% when they arrive in the United States.
X plus 25%. That 25% is basically his entire business operating margin, he says. A lot of businesses are facing that 25% number because it applies to Chinese high-tech goods, and this is the quote, containing industrially significant technology. That's where the Trump administration, as we talked about with Doug Irwin, justifiably wants to hit the Chinese market. So there's going to be some reciprocity in there. But there's, you know, cars, soybeans, whiskey. There's lots of other stuff on these lists.
Yeah, and many companies would be lucky to have a 25% operating margin.
Yeah.
So while some of them can handle the extra costs, Bunny says that with public schools as his main customer, it is an existential business problem.
In terms of, like, you know, the school systems, they have a fixed budget. So if they budgeted like $100 to buy, you know, five kits at $20, right, and then the price goes up, then they can't just go to the administrator and get more money. That doesn't exist in the school system. So now they just teach fewer students, or they don't teach as well, or they just cancel the program altogether because they just don't have the funds to do it. And in particular, because we discount very heavily to educators, that tariff impact, it hurts us even more when it comes to educators. There's no middleman, there's no buffer for us to sort of negotiate with to reduce that. It really is like, you know, teachers just getting less stuff, or we are just not making payroll. Those are kind of the two options that we have.
So just because trade policy, as we know with his administration, changes with the wind, things could change by Friday the 6th, which is when the Chinese and U.S. tariffs are supposed to go into effect. But it's all about uncertainty, right? And this is a tiny startup trying to figure out what to do as it gets stuck in between the entire American economy and the entire Chinese economy getting angry with each other. So what this small startup is trying to do. So here's Bunny Huang's business partner, Ji Qi, talking to us actually from her business trip to China, where she was trying to figure out what she's going to do. Anyway, so here you go.
And so, you know, things that we're doing now that we weren't doing before is, like, you know, we're applying for grants. We're working with nonprofits to help us figure out other ways to bring enough income to keep operating. And, like, it'd be so much better if we didn't have to worry about that and just focused on making awesome tools and great resources for teachers. But unfortunately, more and more, we're spending time focusing on how to keep the company alive rather than designing good things for the world.
Oh, man, I love that. Keep the company alive? Question mark, right? Ugh. I mean, can you imagine being some, what are they, maybe they've got two or three people in an office somewhere and then a bunch of people in China making this stuff, and they're just stuck. I think that's, you know, it's got to be tough.
Well, and the fact that it went, the fact that, I mean, well done, Shara Morris, for finding the entrepreneurs who took it not only from keeping their business alive to, like, the children, to literally, like, the quality of education that can happen as a result of it. That's a gut punch. One thing I should note, though, to your point that things could change between now and July 6th, we did some coverage on Marketplace Tech of the Chinese tech economy and the trade war. And right in the middle of a two-parter with our Shanghai correspondent, Jennifer Pak, the landscape totally changed. We had expected that the Trump administration would announce these extreme restrictions on Chinese investment in tech companies in the United States. And that just turned on a dime almost overnight last week those restrictions did not go into effect. And the reporting was that the administration essentially backed down from at least part of that trade fight. Mm-hmm. So it is important to acknowledge that maybe Europe, Canada, Mexico, and China will all stay strong. But
I don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole, but all of this stuff changes, and it's craziness. If you're getting squeezed by these tariffs, if you're getting hit, if you're seeing something that maybe we're not talking about yet, let us know. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Molly's on Twitter at Molly Wood. I'm at Kai Rizdal. Let us know.
Yeah. And more from you on other topics after this, but this is The Bills. We recently heard from Larissa in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who wrote to tell us that Make Me Smart is the highlight of her week. She especially appreciates how we tie policy, economics, and social and economic theory into a thoughtful, digestible conversation. Thanks, Larissa. If you want to keep Make Me Smart going strong like Larissa does, please join her in donating online at marketplace.org. And thank you so much to all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible. I really like that song. That was really lovely. I'm gonna have to Spotify that. All right, it is time to hear from all of you.
Dear Make Me Smart.
My name's Jessica from Austin.
This is Steve McGillivray from Fountain Hills, Arizona.
This is Sandra Bond in Newport, Oregon.
William Watts sent us a voice memo, a little recording, wanting to know if it's worth getting worked up about over European and American relationships seeming to be a little bit frayed right now, the tariffs being just the latest example of it.
The key point is U.S.-EU relations are in disarray, but that is just a change from a previous time. We aren't at war, we still trade with each other, etc. We just don't have as good of a relationship today as yesterday, which is sad, but it's not that super significant in the grand scheme. Can you tell me when something has changed enough to cause harm versus it is just a small scratch?
Now is when it's changed enough to cause harm. So look, I don't want to be apocalyptic about this, but this is the entire post-World War II order of things being turned on its head. And the idea that we are now at odds with, forget the Canadians for a second, right? Lovely people, but let's think about strategic importance here. And all you Canadians out there, please don't yell at me. Let's think about the idea that the president is going after Western Europe, that he says to the French president, hey, if you leave the European Union, I'll give you a better deal on trade. What?
Yeah. And remember, as you mentioned, post-World War II, the European Union is a peace project.
Yeah, good for you. Good point.
Like, it exists to keep the peace and to be a bulwark against countries like, I don't know, Russia, which are, it's like we forget that one of the weird tribal goals of humanity is to take more territory. Russia is taking more territory, and the European Union exists as a bulwark against just that kind of behavior. So if it is fractured, or if we are not allies as some land-hungry country starts trying to make inroads and annex other parts of the world, things will spiral badly. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. And it's sort of like, I get it. It's hard for us to comprehend, right, how one leads to the other, to the other. It's only like 50 years later that we'll look back on all the different path dependencies that were created here. But like, this is a big part of it. This
Molly Wood reverting to type with a path dependency. That was kind of awesome. That was kind of awesome.
I know. I haven't said that in a really long time. It felt good. Kind of. Yeah. But you know, I try. You can't like overexpose. I don't want to be like The Rock up in here. His agent needs to just put the, like, they need to dial it back with The Rock.
Although I did kind of enjoy Jumanji.
I don't know how I got there, by the way.
I'm just saying.
It was good. No, we watched it like 3 times.
What was the lifeguard one he did? That was terrible. I saw that on a plane. But Jumanji I really liked.
Oh, yeah, Baywatch? The lifeguarding one? You're hilarious.
Although Zac Efron, man, has he been working out. Anyway, back to tariffs and trade.
Right. Yes. Focus. John Casey from Durham asks, if China put a tariff on U.S. origin soy, why doesn't a broker in France just arbitrage the difference, buying American soy for European consumption and selling EU soy on to China?
Wow. I don't know. Off the top of my head, I don't know. There's a reason. So I should probably think about that and tell you what, we'll close the loop next time.
Pass to Tony,
or we'll revisit that one. How about that? We put that in the. Let's do this next week.
Yeah, definitely next week.
There you go. All right. Brittany Rhodes, she called us up, left this voice memo.
I'm a California transplant now in a small town outside of Kansas City, Missouri. And at lunch recently, I got to overhear a conversation between two good old boys in the manufacturing industry. And I was eating alone, not being a creep. They were discussing how the steel tariffs are causing their customers to make changes to their ordering systems out of fear of price fluctuations. And you helped me have a more interesting lunch because I understood what they were talking about rather than me just being a creepy eavesdropper. Thanks for the great show. Keep up the great work.
Well, amen. I love that.
Wow. I love that. But I also, that's an actual example of tariff talk in the wild. Like, it was happening.
That's true. It's totally,
you know,
true.
to this entire question of like, does it matter to people?
Totally,
I mean,
does.
The fact that was just happening in a cafe in Kansas City. Yeah. It's real. All right. That's all we've got for today. We are back next week with, I don't know, some other stuff. Please subscribe to our podcast if you do not already, and not just for the fart jokes. Review us on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends about our scintillating high-level intellectual conversation. And don't forget to try out our new Alexa skill. Just say, you don't even have to enable the skill right now, as far as I know. You just say, Alexa, make me smart. And we
Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Senior producer is Eve Tro. This week's program was engineered by Ben Talladay. Theme music was composed by that very same Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I will talk as long as I want to because it's a podcast. No one can stop me.
Well, we can turn the mic off.